This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, East Sanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Good morning. Do you mind removing your shoes, my friend? Thank you. This week when I was unwell, someone sent me an email referring me to the holy teaching of Vimalakirti. You know that sutra. Actually, that's one translation. The Sanskrit, of course, is just the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. Nirdesha just means a pointing out, so maybe holy teaching's a little too elaborate. But anyway, chapter 5 is something like the advice to the invalid. So I thought that was appropriate. And it's very, it's actually a vehicle for expressing balance between wisdom and compassion. And as you know, that sutra is a very pivotal and important expression of the Mahayana spirit. And as usual, it reserves a certain amount of, definitely not disrespect, but certain amount of finger wagging for say the early disciples of Buddha, who were primarily, at least as they tell the story, as the later redactors tell the story, primarily seem to have been concerned with their own liberation. As perhaps the horizon of Dharma practice widened, this was thought to be kind of unfortunate. And the question began to be entertained, well, why do that? Why be so concerned with our own, so preoccupied with our own fate? Was there not some way to include other beings in our practice? And indeed, follow the example of the great caravan leader, the great physician, Shakyamuni Buddha, who was prevailed upon to share his, or if you like, her discoveries with quite a few beings. And as the story of Shakyamuni's spiritual journey unfolded, these stories began to include more than just his life in this this so-called Jambudvipa, the rose apple continent where we supposedly live, but also other worlds and times. And when he had many births, as many animals and genders and other creatures, in which he also helped many beings. And from this matrix eventually sprang the notion that perhaps what is uppermost, most important in practice life is this vow to help others. And of course, this became known as the Bodhisattva vow. And in the Mahayana, this is the most important thing. The germ of the Bodhisattva vow is what? Duh.
Liberate all beings?
Yeah. And what's that known as?
Enlightenment?
Not exactly. What gives rise to the vow? Is bodhicitta, of course. The notion, first of all, that there is such a thing as awakening, and that it can be turned to the benefit of all beings, the eventual liberation of all beings. And in order to generate, you might say, the enormous merit and power to put in service of that vow, you need two things, insofar as they can be called things, and those are wisdom and compassion. So the great householder, layperson, Vimalakirti, goes on at some length about the importance of these two, and speaks of them in terms of how to apply them to, first of all, someone whom one is visiting who is ill, that is, particularly a bodhisattva who has fallen ill, and also if one is a bodhisattva oneself who has fallen ill. In particular, if one is oneself a bodhisattva who has fallen ill, he says the most important thing is to resist the temptation to conceive of and it might be a strong temptation, disgust for this body. And if one is laboring under illness, that temptation may be rather strong. And believe me, I can attest to that. Because when I have one of my migraines, I am sometimes disgusted with this body. So if someone were to come along and say, here's a path for exit from this realm of suffering, and if followed, you can bid for farewell to it forever, one might be sore tempted. And then if someone were to say, well, here's another path, and there's also exit from this realm of suffering, but you'll also have to return to this same realm in order to help these other beings. So you will also have to return to this and similar bodies for the sake of other beings who suffer. How does that sound? Based on the fact that you are now saddled with this suffering corpse. How do you like that? One might be tempted to say, oh, no thanks. I'm going to take this permanent exit over here. So Vimalakirti says, do not succumb to this temptation. This is very important, he says. And do you know, you remember who his interlocutor is in this chapter, chapter 5? He having...
Manjushri.
Because everyone else refuses to talk to Vimalakirti. So, you know, it's a very important sutra because in earlier chapters, of course, Buddha, as you remember, asks all his top disciples, all of these Sravakas, right, who are all of them arhats, and at least in the earlier tellings, basically the equal of Buddha in their enlightenment, right? And in the earlier, in the Pali suttas, they're almost always referred to as all of them arhats, fully enlightened ones, right? And they've all been humiliated by this layperson in discussions in their specialty. Mahakashyapa, Upali, Ananda, all of these guys. Whatever their specialty is, usually they're giving instruction to other monks or laypersons, and in the process, along comes Vimalakirti and interrupts them and says, no, you're doing that all wrong. Let me tell you. Right? And proceeds to humiliate them. So when Buddha says, I hear Vimalakirti's sick. Could you go and visit him and see how he is? They all go, oh, no, no, thanks. And then Buddha comes to the various bodhisattvas and says, well, could you guys, you know, you're bodhisattvas, could you go and talk to him? And they say, no, rather not. And finally, only Manjushri, in that actual form, the Kumara Bhuta Manjushri, the young adolescent Manjushri. This is Kumara Bhuta means the young man appearing Manjushri. Is that manifestation there? Probably without the sword, I assume. Says, well, okay, I'm not really up for it either, but since you ask, I'll go visit. And they actually have a very lively dialogue, Manjushri being the embodiment of bodhisattva wisdom. They have quite a nice back and forth. Vimalakirti and Manjushri really strut their stuff. Vimalakirti, as I say, counsels against, first of all, disgust for the body and the temptation to take the path of solitary salvation. And then in terms of other beings, he says, beholding other beings, when it comes to other beings, you may be tempted to see them purely as empty. So if you were to counsel a bodhisattva who is him or herself ill, you might be tempted purely to see him or her as empty. And this, of course, is insufficient. Why? Because this only gives the upper hand to wisdom. There is no room here for the play of compassion. So throughout this dialogue, each time Vimalakirti presents wisdom, he goes on to then present compassion. And each time he presents compassion, he goes on to discuss the complementary function of wisdom in exactly that context. So it's quite beautiful. And in so doing, demonstrates the importance of the integral nature of that dynamic, and how the two cannot be separated without doing violence to the health of the Dharma. And as you probably know, and as I'm sure we've mentioned here, Zen is sometimes taken to task as being giving much too much emphasis on wisdom. My own experience is that if wisdom is properly cultivated, it actually frees compassion. Facebook? Maybe it wasn't Facebook. Somewhere or other, I encountered the assertion on the part of somebody where they seemed to be saying that compassion, or at least one could draw the conclusion from what the person was saying, that compassion was a kind of a nice feeling.
Kind of a what?
A nice feeling. And this was brought to my mind from a footnote in, this was Robert Thurman's translation of the Vimalakirti Sutra. Because I read a footnote in his translation where he happened to agree with me entirely, so I thought, yes, Robert Thurman agrees with me, where he said something like, the notion that compassion is a nice feeling, where you sort of have a feeling like, oh, you poor little Ting, is totally wrong. And he cites, I had actually forgotten that the notion of great compassion, which I had begun to associate because of my failing mental powers with an emphasis in Zen and Chan tradition, actually exists in the older sutras too, and appears in Sanskrit as Mahakaruna, great compassion in Sanskrit. As I've mentioned here before, is explicitly separated from a kind of an emotional, affective current of, you know, anything even vaguely resembling pity or a kind of emotive response, that being a very narrow and really rather unimportant subset of great compassion, which is a much vaster response of the entire organism to the sufferings of other beings, which may or may not have an emotional or affective component. It may not at all. Great compassion is the compassion of Avalokiteshvara, who hears the cries of the world, without without doing what most of us do, or what I do, which is actually filtering them out, actually pushing the sufferings of beings away because it's just too much. Great compassion is the inherent capacity of this body-mind to vibrate to the sufferings of beings. And it is no small thing. And wisdom is the response born out of right view in reply. And this is the engine of salvation that on which the bodhisattva runs in saving beings. And if you like, the bodhisattva vow is the fuel. So these are the sorts of contemplations I try to do when I am laboring under illness. And I'll tempt the gods by saying, I haven't had much illness in recent months of the kind of, you know, like colds or flus or anything. It's just my constant battle with migraine headaches. So in one way I'm fortunate, perhaps. But I get enough of these afflictions that I get to do a lot of contemplations of how tempting it is to think of exiting from samsara, period, and not worrying about returning to deal with the sufferings of other beings, and noticing that temptation, and seeing, yes, the path of the Arhat and the Pratyeka Buddha, that's pretty attractive. And in the face of that attraction, renewing the bodhisattva vow not to do that. Realigning myself or this person or oneself with not just, you know, my vow, but the bodhisattva vow, which is much larger than any one person, any one era, any one kalpa or time or conceptualization. Certainly much larger than any one person's suffering, fortunately. And so the challenge is, you know, for a bodhisattva to be able to contemplate suffering beings, see them as empty, and also respond to their sufferings and not dismiss them. This is no small thing. So, what do I mean by seeing them as empty? So, can I see you guys as empty? Well, kind of. First of all, can I just see you guys as you are? Yeah. Well then, since you are empty, can I just see you guys? Yeah. That's an excellent way to start, by the way. Just seeing things as they are, since they are empty, is an excellent way to practice. You don't want to start looking for emptiness in things. This is an error. Things already are without unbeing, so you don't want to start looking for the absence of unbeing. You can, if you want to go that route, then you might want to go to Tibet and indulge in a lengthy monastic curriculum. But you don't necessarily have to go that route. I would suggest start things, seeing things exactly as they are, recognizing that the teaching is quite consistent, that things are already without own being. And notice the tendency just to heap very quickly imputations upon stuff that you're seeing. And as the practice of Zazen, just seeing, illuminates that tendency, allow the process of just seeing to let you help you see that process, and let that stuff fall away. And as the process of just seeing becomes clearer and clearer, see what that does to your, we might say, understanding of emptiness, which is to say, things as they are. Remember, emptiness is not an additional quality. It's very easy to go astray there. So, the challenge, according to Vimalakirti and numerous others, is that numerous beings without, beyond counting, are both empty and needing compassion. And both of those aspects are abundantly served by seeing beings just as they are and responding them to them just as they are, which is, I have to admit, challenging. Nice weather we're having. I prefer rain myself, but I want to acknowledge that most people don't think that way. Any questions this morning? Comments? Complaints? Yes.
Is the other path that you were talking about, the one that's kind of tempting, leaving behind the body, I guess, is that kind of the Hinayana path?
Yes. We try not to use that word since it's disparaging, but yes.
I kind of meant it that way.
Yes.
Yes, you say that when somebody's suffering, they're empty.
Well, they're empty whether they're suffering or not, but yes.
Empty of what?
Own being is the usual phrase. That is, they are in a fundamental sense insubstantial, which means they have what's called, they have only provisional reality. They don't have ultimate reality. They definitely have provisional reality, so we all are provisionally present. Ultimately, no. Ultimately, we have only dependently co-arisen reality. Do you know that expression from Buddhism?
No.
Oh. Well, what we call reality is only a beautifully orchestrated series of mutually dependent factors that lean upon one another. Mm-hmm. So nothing that we see has its own kernel of ultimate reality. Everything leans upon everything else. So that's why we say there's only provisional reality here. Ultimately, there's just, you could say, the one thing. So that's what that means. So we don't deny provisional reality to you, and you or me. We deny ultimate reality. That's, you know, Buddhism for you. So this is a so-called two truths. From the perspective of certain Western philosophers, it's a little slippery, but we don't care. I had a lot of trouble in Western philosophy class in high school. I just found it a headache-inducing mental exercise that, you know, eventuated in nothing very useful. The philosophy teacher was also the headmaster of the school, and he found me very irritating, and vice versa. So, oh well, that's the way it was. Yes.
Thank you for your talk. Mm-hmm. It resonated a lot for me. But one thing that came up, I guess a question maybe, is you were talking about, for lack of a better word, limitless compassion.
Great compassion.
Great compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think of, you know, the work that I do and the beings that I encounter who are in deep suffering and struggle, and also, you know, other people, just friends and people in my life. And I sometimes I can't respond.
Yeah.
You know, or I reach a point where I just can't stretch any farther.
Yep.
And so how does one practice that?
Very interestingly, Vimalakirti speaks to that exact point. He says, and I have the same experience, and he says to those of us who have that experience, well, we're not quite developed yet, because our you might say our view is a little off, and therefore we are, he uses, at least in Thurman's translation, he says we become exhausted as a result, because we're not quite there with right view. We're not quite seeing all things as empty yet. If we were, we would not be exhausted. So we're doing reasonably well with compassion, but because we're not quite there with right view, we're being drained by wrong view. Right? So do what we can. You know, I this happens all the time, you know. I walk from here to the gym. By the time I get to the gym, if one more person asks me for money, I'm gonna say no. You know, it's like I can't do this anymore. I just can't. I'm just gonna turn away from you and say, no, I'm sorry, you know, I'm out of change. And even if I'm not out of change, I'm not going to give you any more money. That's just it. You know? And maybe as I walk by, I will see you as empty, and that's about all I can do for you today, buddy. And that's it. You know? And that's the limit. And maybe, you know, tomorrow or next week or next birth, it will be different. And my working of right view will have improved. And I'll continue to make the effort and renew the vow indefinitely, forever, as long as there are beings. But for right now, that's it. That's all I can do. And so, also need to take care of this body mind. And somewhere or other, Vimalakirti gives that the nod too. He was, after all, a layperson with a family. So, now, probably he was an example of one who did not get exhausted, even though he was ill.
Well, then he's pretending to be
ill. Yeah, I think he was pretending to be ill. You know, it's like, okay, his illness was better than my supreme health. So I was like, okay, I'd settle for that. But for now, we'll just do what we can.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah. During a talk with the word compassion coming up over and over again, I couldn't help but see images of Islam in my head, because I had the great good fortune to, as far as I'm concerned, see Avalokiteshvara in action. Mm-hmm. And with him, I remember one time he said, compassion is, you fall down, I help you up. But it wasn't that, oh, you poor thing, let me come to your aid. Mm-hmm. It was an immediate and natural response to the event at hand.
Right.
That's all it was.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think most people, I think I'm safe in saying most people, when they would observe him, they would see this motherly tenderness, mm-hmm. which of course is one aspect of the Bodhisattva of compassion.
Mm-hmm.
I also saw the sword of Manju Shri come slashing down once or twice
mm-hmm.
as the situation called for.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, so it was... pretty far out to see that in a person, and because normally I think we tend to get all philosophical about it and think that it's some sort of rarefied
right.
thing or an unobtainable state or
right.
any of that stuff, but to see it in reality is quite amazing and inspiring.
Yeah, right. Quite so. Yeah. And as you say, it's often quite simple and immediate. You fall down, I help you up. Yeah.
I was reminded when you were talking of some developments in psychology that have been around for several decades. Everyone's seen nastiness and aggressive violence in children. But at the earliest stage, there are a famous set of experiments that have been repeated and repeated, where if you have a group of children together, young children, not babies maybe, but a little more, but not like 7 or 8, if something bad happens to one, that they're hit or they fall down and hurt themselves or they start to cry, there's a spontaneous movement at that age that testifies to a sense of oneness. And sometimes they can't even manage to get over to help them because they just start crying. They can't tell the difference, in other words, mm-hmm. between themselves and the other person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that always seemed to me kind of a empirical backup of Buddhist views
mm-hmm.
that you could
mm-hmm.
use with people to mm-hmm. try and get across something.
Mm-hmm. They're aware of distress.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And not so concerned that it's, quote, not my own.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.